And welcome to this week's podcast from Innovation Forum for Friday, 12th of October, with me, Ian Welsh. In the podcast this week, we've got the usual digest of news and comment. Plus, when I was in Detroit last week, I talked with Mondelez International's Christine McGrath and Ipsos's Megan Jones about the deforestation and social impacts of Mondelez's Cocoa Life programme in the forests of West Africa. And my colleague Tanya Richard recently spoke with Cindy Rhodes, CEO of textile recyclers Worn Again Technologies. Before that, though, a weekly review of some of what's happening in business and sustainability. It's been hard to avoid the frankly alarming report from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change published this week. The stark reality is that the world's leading climate scientists agree that urgent and unprecedented change is required to keep global temperature rises to within 1.5 Celsius of that of pre-industrial levels. Previous thinking had suggested that keeping temperature rises to 2 Celsius would avoid the worst effects of climate change, the drought, floods, ecosystem collapse, widespread food supply crises, and all the rest. But the most recent analysis concludes that only a 1.5 Celsius increase or less will do. Currently, the world is 1 Celsius warmer than pre-industrial times, and in its report, the IPCC makes clear that the effects of climate change are already upon us, with devastating tropical storms in the Atlantic and the Pacific, droughts in southern Africa, unprecedented warming in the Arctic, to name but a few. Amid many lessened impacts, the IPCC says that at a 1.5 Celsius increase rather than 2 Celsius, hundreds of millions of people fewer, particularly in poor countries, would be at risk of climate-related poverty. The IPCC's pathways to achieving 1.5 Celsius include significant reforestation, a rapid shift to electric transport systems and renewable fuels in general, and adoption of carbon capture technology. We've got about 12 years to make the changes, scientists say, before the key climate tipping points will be triggered. At that point, irreversible change becomes hard to stop. The better news is that IPCC says we can still turn the bus around, but that change has to be effectively immediate in terms of moving from fossil fuel-based energy, and will also rely on yet unrealised carbon capture technology. So politicians must act. But the muted response from many European governments and the downright hostility to climate action from the current US administration, Australia, and the incoming leadership in Brazil does not give cause for much optimism. So what can business do? Most importantly, ignore this report at your peril. It's clear that ultimately net zero emissions is going to be required and will be set by governments if they ever get fully up to speed. So companies can start planning for that now while preparing their operations and, crucially, supply chains for the impacts that even a 1.5 Celsius increase will bring. Where food will be grown is going to continue to change, and supply security for commodities essential for many brands will become an ever greater challenge. More positively, the IPCC report should spur on the companies that recognise that leadership on mitigating climate impacts is only ever going to be a business positive position to be in. And a recent report from the Global Fossil Fuel Divestment and Clean Energy Investment Movement suggests that the investment community might be recognising this, as almost 1,000 institutional investors with $6.24 trillion in assets under management have committed to divest from fossil fuels, up from just $52 billion in 2014. Maybe there is a sense that fossil fuel companies are beginning to lose their social licence to operate. Which is, of course, something that many campaigners have been saying for some time about palm oil growers who continue to clear forests and peatlands. And Swiss food giant Nestle has pledged to blacklist its suppliers who are non-compliant with its responsible sourcing policies in March 2019 next year. The name and shame move is part of the company's goal for transparency in its work to eliminate its palm oil supply chain of products linked with deforestation. Nestle says it will cut links to non-compliant suppliers, having already axed 10 this June. This desire to verify the actions of its suppliers was part of the company's disagreement and temporary suspension from the Roundtable on Sustainable Palm Oil earlier this year, of course. Currently, Nestle says it is able to trace 60% of palm oil to plantations where it is grown and 95% to the mills where it is processed, with the help of the Starling satellite sensing system developed by Airbus and Forest Group TFT. Elsewhere this week, and rather overshadowed by the IPCC report, was the launch of the latest forced labour benchmark from Know the Chain, this time on 38 of the largest global food and beverage companies. It is found that these businesses typically are taking little to no action to engage and empower workers in their supply chains. Workers in the agricultural sector that help harvest and produce food often work in remote locations, which makes them particularly vulnerable to abuse and exploitation. Top performers in the benchmark are usual suspects Unilever, Kellogg, Coca-Cola and Nestle. And the research highlights that high-profile companies and brands tend to take these issues more seriously for a number of obvious reasons, while companies that have lower profiles have made less progress. For example, the bottom two ranked businesses were owner of world's largest pork business WH Group and packaged food company Almari. Know the Chain's research also suggests that there remains too much focus on some commodities, such as palm oil, with other value chains with similar human rights risks staying out of the spotlight. Food for thought indeed. Innovation Forum will be in Amsterdam on Monday 15th and Tuesday 16th October next week for our next conference on how business can tackle plastic pollution. Last few tickets are still available. And then Wednesday 17th and Thursday 18th, we are at Freshfields in London discussing modern slavery, forced labour and human rights. And coming up in November on the 6th and 7th is our marquee Sustainable Landscapes Conference in London. It's going to be a cracking event with 250 delegates and four distinct tracks across the 2 days covering land, forests, farmers and technology and innovation. Conference passes are being snapped up, but there is still a chance to join us. Full details of all our events are in this week's newsletter or via the Innovation Forum website. Interview time now. While I was in Detroit with Innovation Forum last week, I spoke with Christine McGrath, Mondelez International's Chief Wellbeing, Sustainability, Public and Government Affairs Officer, and Megan Jones, Senior Vice President, Corporate Sustainability and Citizenship, Ipsos. We talked about cocoa supply chains and why a holistic approach is the one that can achieve corporate deforestation and social goals. Chris, why don't you explain a little bit around what CocoaLife is, why Mondelez created it, and how it links to your business impacts?
Well, CocoaLife is, first of all, Mondelez International. We're one of the world's largest snack food companies, and we have brands like Oreos and Cadbury Chocolate, Toblerone, Milka, etc. CocoaLife is our signature sustainability program. We launched it back in 2012 with a $400 million investment over a 10-year time frame, and our ambition really is to transform our cocoa supply chain by working directly with farmers and communities with a holistic approach that will empower the farmers to create a better future for themselves and grow opportunities for everyone in the community.
Megan, impact measurement. This is something we've been talking about a lot. It's something that sounds quite easy, but actually is really complicated. What does impact measurement really mean, and what specifically does it mean in the context of CocoaLife?
Yeah, so I think in the corporate sustainability world, what people are more accustomed to seeing is certification and labels programs. So those programs really look at the processes by which companies achieve sustainability and verify that those processes are taking place. What impact evaluation does is go a step further and look at, as a result of those processes having taken place, what is the outcome for the beneficiaries, if you like, of the program. So we work with businesses to understand what are the outcomes and impacts that they are trying to achieve. We build theories of change to understand how exactly they're going to achieve that through their supply chain programs. And then typically we implement longitudinal studies that may be quantitative, qualitative, a mixture of both, to look at change over time. So is that company achieving its impact? And then beyond even that, how and why that impact is being achieved. Learning is a really key, important piece when it comes to impact evaluation. A business will do impact evaluation to really understand what's working and why, so that they can better target their investments in the future.
One of the key factors or key characteristics of CocoaLife is that it's a holistic program. It tries to cover all the various aspects, all the challenges facing cocoa farmers, particularly in West Africa. Why did you adopt this holistic approach, and what challenges does that bring about?
Basically, when you look at the challenges, as you say, they're interrelated. So cocoa farming is done mostly by smallholder farmers, by over 5 million farmers, in, for example. And so they have very small plots of land. They tend to have low productivity, and they live in communities where there's not a whole lot of infrastructure. So often not electricity, not good water. So these are not attractive places to live. And so the education levels, access to schools and good education is low. And so it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy that the farmers don't have access to create to means to improve their farms. and their living conditions. The next generation of youth doesn't want to stay there and continue to farm the business. The parents don't necessarily want their kids to stay in the communities. And so as a business, you know, we are one of the world's largest chocolate companies and largest buyers of cocoa. We need a healthy, thriving cocoa supply chain for our future growth plan. So this is a business imperative for us. We take this holistic approach because the challenges are interrelated. So if we can help farmers learn how to farm more cocoa on less land or on like the existing amount of land they have, that improves their incomes, it improves the quality of life for their families, it helps give kids more access to education, it helps to therefore tackle deforestation because they're not cutting down more forests with their low productivity levels. So that's why we say the challenges are interrelated, and it's really important to have a holistic solution that involves farming and community development.
So, I mean, you're investing $400 million over 10 years. So it's a significant investment. But what does that mean at the farm level? Because from what you've been saying, you really get down, right down and dirty at the farm level. It's not a kind of one of these programs where you do a little bit and it scales out from that. You've got to go down and engage with all the different farmers. What does it look practically at a farm level?
Sure. That's a great question. So at a farm level, practically, it means we work in partnership with our suppliers. So the suppliers are the cocoa traders. They do a lot of the work anyway of working with farmers on sort of the health of the farms. And so we partner with them and we pay for training of good agricultural practices. We invest in nurseries to have good new planting materials, help farmers get access to fertilizer. So planting inputs and better practices is one practical thing a farmer would experience. And then we also work with NGOs who are skilled at doing community needs assessments. And so we pay for these NGOs to go in and work with the farming communities and help them figure out how to work together to develop, like, what are the common needs? What do they want for the future of their community? And then they develop what we call a community action plan. So that's the tangible output. I think about it as a strategic plan for their community. And then within that, then, okay, so how can the community work for achieving that? How can they advocate with local governments? How can they work to get funding from the farming, better outputs and livelihoods? We work a lot with women and women's empowerment because women are a key factor in cocoa farming and into creating stronger communities, giving them a voice. And we set up village savings and loan associations so that the women have also a way to save money and have access to financing for like a new business and invest in new livelihoods training. So all of those pieces are the kinds of things that the local farm and the farming community would benefit from.
Is it a risk when you are helping farmers increase their income and obviously also doing things like developing community infrastructure and schools and everything else? Is there a risk or an unintended consequence that you then are providing an opportunity for the children of these farmers to leave farming entirely, which of course is not what you're trying to do? How do you marry that together?
So it's a great question, and we see it as the future of cocoa, and our business is a vibrant cocoa supply chain, which means that the whole cocoa supply would be modernized. So part of that is developing the infrastructure in the places where the farmers and their families live, mm-hmm. providing access to education so there can be, you know, new businesses that those educated children come back and grow, that they can have access to different livelihoods other than cocoa farming. The cocoa farms themselves are pretty small, like the individual farmers have maybe 2-3 hectares, and often they have, you know, multiple children. So part of sort of the natural evolution of a healthy community is that 5 or 6 children aren't going to be able to support themselves and their families someday off of one piece of land. So the fact that they are educated and can go off and do other things and build up the local community is part of the future sustainability that we're looking for.
It feels to me that this thinking around developing sustainable communities is really something that's developing right now. Megan, I wonder, is that something you're seeing in other sectors? I know in palm oil now, but a lot of talk about the sustainable community aspect rather than just thinking about the farm and the farmer. What extent are you seeing this developing elsewhere?
Well, I think the Cocoa Life program is fantastically ambitious in its scope. It's not just focusing on the cocoa farming piece, which would be the really obvious piece to focus on. It's trying to take this holistic approach, which I think is fairly unique right now in the private sector. But as you say, and I agree with you, there is a lot more emphasis now on looking at the bigger picture, looking at broader empowerment and context when sustainable development programs are being implemented, because without an enabling structure in place, we're not going to see the economic growth and the human development that we would like to see. So it's kind of community pieces being brought into development programs. I think it's incredibly smart, because that is what's going to make the development sustainable in the future. At some point, communities have to be empowered to take on their own development, and that's exactly what the ambition of Cocoa Life is, and I think it's a really great development.
For cocoa, we're really talking about West Africa, and really, in particular, we're talking about Ghana and Côte d'Ivoire. How has the multi-stakeholder initiative, the Cocoa in the Forest initiative in Ghana and Côte d'Ivoire, which truly multi-stakeholder, government, NGOs, business, everyone there, how has this affected the implementation of Cocoa Life?
It helped to instigate the creation of it, actually, because we've been working on the environmental part of cocoa farming since the inception of the program and have been announcing some of our own public or private partnerships in this space starting back in 2015. So it actually, I think, really helps to accelerate the progress that we make. You know, no one company is going to be able to solve these challenges on their own. And so we work in partnership with other cocoa companies, as well as all of the traders through the World Cocoa Foundation. And that was a key part of then getting the governments and the stakeholders engaged around the table and taking a common approach. I think we get more synergy. I think we get common approach in terms of, like, all of us saying, okay, this would be what we're trying to tackle in terms of land management, eradicating deforestation, no human rights abuses, etc. So having a common set of principles that we're all marching towards, I think, helps to accelerate progress. And there's a lot of accountability there too for all of us, which I think is really important. All boats rise together. So I think it only just then helps all of us. So we're super excited sure. about it, actually.
Okay, just in closing then, you're 5 years in a 10-year program, is that
yes.
right? So what's your biggest success and what's been the biggest challenge?
Our biggest success, I think, is now that we're at the point where we are working with over 120,000 cocoa farmers in over 1,100 communities in 6 origins where we buy cocoa from. And 35% of our cocoa is now, and we're a very big chocolate company. So 35% of our cocoa is now sourced through Cocoa Life and then on brands like Cadbury and Milka. So we're starting to achieve some scale and we're starting to see some of the results on the ground in terms of benefits to farmers and communities. And we're in the process of getting more of the data through Ipsos and Megan's team. I think the biggest challenge is just trying to really decipher exactly what is working on the ground as the program grows and scales, just trying to come back to really being able to know in detail what's working, what to accelerate, and what are the gaps that we need to address as we move forward to have the kind of lasting change that we want. I think the other challenge, I would say, is that, you know, it all comes down to sort of the implementation on the ground. And this is about farmers and communities wanting to change for themselves and figuring out, you know, how to help incentivize that so they can create better futures. This isn't something that we can do for them. It's something that we can support them in. That's one of the biggest challenges, I think, in development.
Sure. Great progress, because as you say, a lot of challenges still to come. Christine Montrigan-McGrath from Mondelez International and Megan Jones from Ipsos, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm delighted we've got a new voice on the podcast this week, my colleague Tanya Richard, who recently spoke with Cindy Rhodes, CEO of Worn Again Technologies, about how the apparel sector can develop a more circular value chain model, and specifically the challenges around tackling plastic microfiber pollution from clothing.
Hello, and welcome to another Innovation Forum podcast. I am Tanya Richard, Project Director here at Innovation Forum. With me here, I have Cindy Rhodes, who is the founder and CEO at Worn Again Technologies, a polymer recycling innovator. Welcome to the podcast, Cindy.
Hi, Tanya. Thank you.
Cindy, why don't you kick things off by telling us a little bit more about what Worn Again does?
We are a polymer recycling technology innovation company. We set out to tackle the global problem of textile waste. Over 50 million tons of textiles go to the landfill every year. And that is a problem we set out to overcome over 10 years ago. And more recently, with the technology that we have been developing over the last 7 years. And a quick overview of the technology itself. We've developed a process that's able to take in polyester and cotton textiles, both pure and blends. And we are able to separate out, we're separating the fibers, the polyester and the cotton. We're able to decontaminate the raw materials, separating out dyes, finishes, all the things that go into textile production, to be able to recapture the raw materials, the polyester and the cellulose from cotton, to go back into the textile supply chain as new virgin equivalent raw materials.
So you've mentioned the waste issue. So speaking of this immense waste issue in the apparel industry, more than 25% of all manufactured fiber actually flows out of the textile supply chain as pre-consumer leftovers from garment production. So I was just wondering, where have you sourced your fabrics from and where do you source them now? And why have you decided on these sources?
Our process can deal with any polyester and or cotton. It doesn't matter where it comes from. The feedstock, what we call feedstock, is quite key to the process. So when we set out to tackle this problem, we were looking at end of use consumer wear, because that's a huge problem. But you're absolutely right. A very high volume of manufacturing waste is also produced. We don't care where it comes from. If it can no longer be reused as textiles, we want to be able to take it back into our process and recapture those valuable raw materials and prevent the use of virgin resources. And just to clarify, so we are still in the development phase. We are reaching the commercialization phase of development, where we will be building a first plant and multiple plants from there. But we're still a couple years away from market. And until then, it's all about the development and getting the technology optimized to the point where we can accelerate from a first plant onwards from there.
Then overall, what do you see as the primary benefits of your technology in this process?
The challenge of textiles waste is massive. It's global. There is a reason why less than 1% of end-of-use textiles go back into making new textiles today. And the reason for this, there's two big challenges. The current methods for recycling textiles, primarily mechanical, are limited in two ways. They're unable to strip out the dyes, the other contaminants that went into the textiles at the very beginning. And they're also unable to separate blended fibers. So once you've mixed together polyester and cotton into a textile, it's virtually impossible separating them using today's methods. So benefit number one of our process is we're able to separate blended fibers. We're able to decontaminate the raw materials, separate out dyes, finishes, all the stuff that you don't want going back into the supply chain at the beginning. The other kind of major benefit is that with a technology like ours, which is commonly called chemical recycling as opposed to mechanical recycling, the key benefit is that it will actually enable the industry to go circular. It's the missing link. Yes, you can have reuse, you can have leasing models, you can design clothes to last longer, but ultimately when those materials are no longer usable as clothing, we want to prevent them from being downcycled and going into landfill. We want to recapture those raw materials and get them back into the supply chain. We have enough resources and enough end-of-use textiles and plastic bottles, that's also polyester, around the world today to satisfy our annual demand for new raw materials. So all we need to do is recapture them.
Following up on that, to what extent then do you think that this circularity, the circular supply chain, is possible in the textiles industry?
It depends how you define circular. I mean, for us, it's about a world where the raw materials that go into clothing captured and restored and to virgin equivalent, so they can be part of the continual cycle again and again and again. Reuse is part of that. There are multiple facets to circularity, but when you're talking about the raw materials, the key aspect of that today is ensuring that they stay in circulation. So rather than throwing it into the bin, we need consumers to get those textiles back into collection systems, whether it's at a charity, a textile bank, wherever or whoever is doing textile collection. As long as that's happening, we can divert those textiles from landfill, we can recapture the raw materials and make a circular future. But it's going to take everyone. There's not just one technology that will enable it. There's not just one brand. It's a fully joined up effort by the brands, the retailers, to communicate to consumers, to educate, to say this garment should never go into landfill, should never get thrown away. Make sure you return it, whether it's in store, whether it's collection banks. There's end of use collectors, there's local authorities. Everyone has to play a part in keeping those resources in circulation. Eventually, they come to a technology like ours, reprocess them, and then we just link back into the supply chain as currently happens today. It sounds complicated, but actually all we're doing is replacing the inputs into our textiles with existing textiles.
So you've mentioned that stripping contaminants and separating blended fabrics were a main challenge that you saw within the space. Could you elaborate a bit more about the main challenges that you faced and how you've overcome them?
Yeah, I mean, it's been quite a roller coaster of a road. We're now in year 7 of a technology that, from what I'm told, taking a new idea or a new concept like this from lab scale to industrial scale or a first plant on average takes around 10 years, which is a very long time. So finding investors at the beginning that believe in that long road is very, very difficult to find. The technology challenges themselves, strangely enough, have been easy enough to overcome. One thing doesn't work, we go down another road. The real, real challenge for us has been getting that long-term financial approach and support that you need for something like this. And so one of the ways we've tackled that is by identifying the organizations that also want to see this solution happen. We partnered up with H&M very early on in our development. They've been a long-term supporter. We've worked with Kering and their brand Puma in the early years as well. And we've now partnered with additional investors, as well as our new chemical engineering partner, Sulzer Chemtech. So really finding those companies out there that really see legs in it and want to be a part of making it happen. The world of VCs, private equity, much, much more difficult. We couldn't find the interest because most VCs want to see a return very early on. And when you've got a long-term development plan, it's just not of interest.
So it is no secret that the major environmental costs of plastic pollution have taken a major center stage this past year. However, while the apparel industry hasn't been mentioned all too much in this discourse, it is, of course, still a major contributor to the issue. So could you maybe elaborate a bit more about how and where your technology sits within the plastics debate and how does it contribute as a solution?
Half of our process deals with polyester in textiles, which is a plastic, PET, it's a polymer. And it's definitely, in terms of bottles and textiles, the growing plastics problem is a big one and it's multifaceted. Some people think let's ban plastic altogether. Our view is that we've already put the energy into drilling for oil and producing all of this plastic. We have it, it's above ground. Let's find a way to recycle it, to keep it in continual circulation. The challenges are multifaceted, certainly around bottles. You get a lot of bottles going out to sea, into the oceans, directly, indirectly. We're getting microfibers through our laundry and washing machines going into the rivers and water streams. It's a tricky one with polyester. So we sit a couple steps back in that supply chain before the microfibers. We are able to recapture polymers from existing textiles, bring them back up to virgin equivalent, which then go back into fiber and textiles all over again. The problem with microfibers is it happens primarily during consumer use, during washing, where small parts of the polymer chain will break off and end up in the water system. While our technology can't directly deal with the challenge, there are complementary ones that we absolutely need to be looking at around filtering our wastewater systems, new innovations in textile design, fiber design, that might be able to deal with the issue. It's not directly a part of our technology, but we're absolutely looking and wanting to be part of other solutions that are in development.
You mentioned the issue of microfibers. We ran a conference on apparel and sustainability within the apparel industry earlier this year, which you spoke at. And it was hard to find apparel brands that wanted to speak on the session focused around microfiber pollution. Do you see a change in the space where the apparel industry is stepping up and further also joining the fight on plastic pollution?
Yeah, definitely. I think there's probably a reticence around it for a couple of reasons. Primarily because it's really become an issue on people's radar quite recently, and it's grown in momentum even just in the past year. So I think there's a lot of unknowns, and companies are wanting to understand more about the problem. There's a lot more research happening around it to identify the source of the problem, the source of the problems, and how it can be tackled. So I think there's definitely a growing interest and a focus on it with a lot more research happening. I'm involved in Textile Exchange's RPET working group, and it's come up as a major issue in that group. And we know that there are other similar types of groups also, you know, focusing on the issue and wanting to find out how it can be tackled in the future. But I definitely think it's not being ignored. People are concerned and wanting to understand how to go about. But again, just like creating circularity, it's going to take multiple stakeholders working together to find a solution to it. And I think there's still a long road to go on finding that solution.
It'll be very interesting to see how this will all develop in the next months and years.
Yeah, I mean, it's tricky because polyester, you know, has since taken over cotton as the most popular fiber being used in textile production. So it's so prevalent in all of our production that to simply ban it is not very realistic. So tackling the problem and finding ways to deal with it, I think, is where we need to focus energies.
So Cindy, to wrap up, where do you see this going into the future? What do you see as the potentials of your process in One Again?
We're very excited about the future of circularity. It's a space that 7 years ago when we started out with the technology, there was very little discussion and the word circular was not used very broadly or widely. And now it's everywhere. The industry is talking about it, wanting to achieve it. How do we do it? How do we get there? And the doors have really opened up in terms of our vision and being able to bring a technology like this to market. Our goal is as soon as we have completed developments and we have the blueprint for a production plant, we will build that first production plant and we will scale as quickly as possible around the world. Our goal is to overtake the use of virgin resources. And so we need as many partners, producers, plant operators, all on board, wanting to be part of that solution. We also want to see the brands really getting involved in the technology that can enable circularity, to get involved, to back these technologies, and to be a part of making it happen, because it's their market demand that's going to drive and accelerate the shift, you know, showing the investment world, showing the raw material producers that this isn't just a fad, it's a long-term ambition, and everyone needs to get on board to make it happen.
Great, Cindy. Well, thank you very much for joining me today on this podcast.
Thank you so much. It's been great talking to you, Tanya.
Don't forget, next week we'll be debating business and what it must do about plastic pollution in Amsterdam on the 16th and 17th, and human rights and modern slavery in London on the 18th and 19th, and then sustainable landscapes in London on the 6th and 7th November. That's it for now. I've been Ian Welsh. I'll be reporting from Amsterdam next week, and until then, goodbye.